Good morning, everyone. It's good to be together this morning. It's been a really fun week. How many of you were at any part of this thing? Yeah, a number of you. Okay, great. So you know, that means you were sequestered in this building all day, every day, for the entire week. But for the rest of you, I just want to just thank you for being in a church that will host an event like this. It's a lot of work, a lot of volunteers, people in this church all over the country, and you're in a great church that would build and prepare in a way that you could host people from all over the country, all over the world, and it's been an exceptional week, and honestly, it's because this church exists. So if you give and you serve and you're a part of this church, I just want to say thank you. Thank you so much for investing in the movement. You probably didn't even know. You're like, okay. I didn't agree to that, but okay. But you did agree to that. If you're serving and helping build this church, it helps build not just the country, but all over the world. So thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And it occurred to me as I was praying, flying over here, that I've been coming to the UK and really to this church for 20 years, which means I was right around 8 or 9 when I started here. So it's been great. I was a very good 9-year-old preacher, but and you know, of course, I've been friends with John and Debbie, and just watched this church grow and change, and of course the leadership God's given them, and I just would commend them to you as leaders. You have such a gift in your leaders, and getting to know John in this transition, and some of the new team folks that, you know, seem very young to me, because I'm old. They're not young, they're actually old. That just means I'm older. And you just have such a great group of leaders. I would just want to commend your pastors to you. They really love you. And they love the church. And honestly, you can't take that for granted. I travel all over the world. I get to be in all kinds of churches. You can't take for granted that your pastors actually love the Lord and love your church and love your city. You really can't take that for granted. They're a gift to you, a stewardship. So if you've not said thank you recently, you probably should. But I want to share with you a message that honestly, it's sort of already who you guys are, so it feels a little redundant, but I hope it's an encouragement to you nonetheless, in that, you know, you have to be reminded of things from time to time, don't you? I love the way that Paul writes to the Philippians, and he says, you know, I want to remind you of these things. You have these things, but I want to remind you, just so you keep them at the front of your mind. And that's most basically what I want to share with you today, something that I think is near and dear to the heart of this church. And if maybe you're new, it'd probably be helpful for you. But actually, there's another thing that's a little strange about what I want to share with you. And it's simply this. I think that this talk might just be for one or two of you. Have you had the moment where you realize in church yet that church isn't for you every week? Have you ever had that experience? No? Well, you might today. The church isn't for you. Like, you have this weird thought, like, wait a minute, like, that wasn't exactly what I needed. And I think often, if not pretty much every week, God assembles all of us so that he can get one person's attention. Maybe two people's attention. From time to time, we're that one person. Like, you know, when we gather at our church in Colorado, somebody will come up, like, crying, you know, sobbing, something's happened to them, or crying, like something happened with God. They're like, oh my gosh, I'm such a mess. I can't believe this is happening. And I'm always like, oh, it's okay. This happens all the time. And it'll be somebody else's turn next week. Sorry, it's your turn this week. But it'll be somebody else next week. And I do think that's kind of how it works. And it's possible that there's one or two of you here that you're not even sure what you're doing here. I have no idea why I'm here. Somebody tricked me into this, or I woke up in the middle of the morning and middle of the night and I knew I had to be here. And so I really hope If you're kind of somewhat aware of that, I really hope you dial in. You really pay attention. And the rest of us can just endure this time. Because the teaching of Jesus and what's clear throughout all of the Gospels is that Jesus' ministry was focused on people who were outside. He regularly focused on the people that other people weren't focusing on. You know, in any social setting, in any group, there's people on the inside and there's people on the outside, right? You know you're on the inside versus being on the outside. And we all know what it feels like to be an insider. I know what the jokes are. I know how things go. And we all know what it's like to be on the outside. Like, I'm a little unfamiliar. I don't know the customs. I don't know where to stand. I don't know what we're going to eat. And there might be any number of you in this room. You're like, oh my gosh, you already made me eat something. I don't know. Dipped it? It's gross. Right? Soggy. Anyway, but I'm not used to this. I don't know what this is. And the clear teaching, the clear emphasis of Jesus' ministry is to the outside. And that aim, that attention, that focus on people on the outside offended those on the inside. It was irritating. It was frustrating. It made them angry because the people that are the good religious types, the people that take things very seriously, and throughout the course of the New Testament, that would be the Pharisees. You know, they're the people who, you know, have given their whole lives for this. And so they're frustrated. Like, Jesus, why aren't you paying attention to us? Why aren't you noticing what we're doing? Why haven't you come to, like, take care of us? We're the people that are really taking all this very seriously. You're spending time with these other people. What are you doing? And throughout the New Testament and throughout the Gospels, you notice this tension is building all through the Gospels to where, frankly, it gets intense enough, they're angry enough that they kill him. They're like, that's it. We got to take this guy out. He is creating problems and he's not sticking with what he should be sticking with. He's not paying attention to who he should be paying attention to. And when you read through the Gospel of Luke, this tension continues to build all the way through until we come to one chapter where Jesus takes it on head on. Like, he's kind of addressing these different groups here and there, Pharisees. But in Luke chapter 15, he stops everything and says, all right, I'm going to address this. I'm going to address why I'm focused the way I am and how this is offending you. So Luke chapter 15, verse 1, Luke writes this. It's sort of a backdrop. He says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. So again, here they are. All the people on the edge. All the people that didn't feel welcome in church. All the people that felt like God had forgotten about them. All the people that felt like they're the misfits. They're the ones who misbehave. They're the ones coming towards Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. They're frustrated. Jesus goes on to tell three stories back to back. And each of these stories is intended to demonstrate what he's doing and why he's doing it. Now, he doesn't do this again all the time, but in these, he does them in a row. And they're fairly well-known stories. They're stories you've probably heard before, and they all center on lostness. It's the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son. And they kind of build on one another, and all three are demonstrating an emphasis. By the way, this is the point of the sermon where everybody who's been raised in church goes, oh no, I know these stories. Can I go now? Or what are the rules? If I leave, is there a way to leave quickly? I'd like you to try to listen to them as though you've not heard them before. And listen with the context in mind that Jesus is addressing why he's doing what he's doing. Because, well, frankly, we need to catch God's heart because it's what God calls us to be doing if we want to be in the ministry of Jesus. So, first story is a parable of the lost sheep. Remember the story? So, suppose a man has 100 sheep, one of them wanders off. Does he not leave the 99 and go after the one? And when he finds the one, he throws that sheep on his shoulders. He comes all the way back to his friends. He gathers his friends together and says, rejoice with me, for the sheep that was lost is now found. And then Jesus has this crazy line at the end of that. He says, I tell you that in the same way, listen to this, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than 99 righteous people. One more than 99. That focus. Now, in doing this, he's using language in a context they'd be familiar with, right? He's talking to farmers, people that are used to this. They see sheep around. Anybody ever been around sheep? Any sheep people in the room? Okay, sheep. Some sheep people, there's maybe a dozen of you. I would have expected more in England. But there's a dozen. So 12 sheep people in the room. So I'm going to tell something to the rest of you. The 12 of you know this. But there's some interesting things that are happening here that, again, if we're not in the context, we don't really understand. One being that sheep are exceptionally dumb. They're like shockingly dumb creatures. Like if they're left alone, they will die quickly. If you would like to fall into a YouTube wormhole on this rainy day, I'm going to give you one right now. If you just search in YouTube, like rescuing sheep, there are dozens and dozens of videos of like a sheep that like kind of wedged itself in like a crevice, you know, like in the ground or like in a rock, and its legs are just sticking out. And a farmer will come and just kind of yank them out and set them free. And they bound away and then they just jump right into a crevice again. Like there, by the way, I'm serious. I just warned you, I'm not responsible if you lose the rest of your day. Because you know how you went and watch one, there's all the like suggested more. If you like this, you would like sheep stuck in well, sheep stuck in river. Okay, so there's like hundreds of these because they are exceptionally stupid. And that should make you think a minute, because that's what Jesus says you are. Actually, the whole Bible says that. Like all the way through the scriptures, when God refers to his people, he's like, you know, my sheep. He doesn't say my clever foxes. It's my sheep. My sheep hear my voice. You know, these are. I am the shepherd and you are the sheep. And another thing that's true about sheep is if they get alone, they die. Like that's why you have to leave the 99 and go get them, because if they get alone, they die. And it's an interesting lesson. It's something for us to think about, that if you are trying to follow Jesus alone, you're probably hurting yourself. That this idea that people can say, well, I love Jesus, but I hate the church, makes no sense in the scriptures. Makes no sense in the history of the church. Like the idea that you're going to have a life with God that's independent of God's people means you're probably on the verge of injuring yourself. And so this sheep wanders off, this dumb creature, and Jesus says, you leave the 99, go get the one. Now, here's another interesting thought. You know, when shepherds find a sheep that wanders away, one of the ways they tend to get the sheep home, and I've actually seen this in the Middle East, one of the ways they get the sheep home is the shepherd will literally bend down and break the leg of the sheep. So make it so it can't run away. That's one reason. The other is then he throws the sheep on his shoulders, and it's a way of sort of making the sheep remember the shepherd's voice. Be close to the shepherd, smell the scent of the shepherd, be drawn back in with the shepherd. It turns out when people have pain in their life, they tend to come back to God. They wander off, they screw up their life, and they have pain and they think, I got to figure this out with God. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Right? You've had that experience? So the next time you see that image of Jesus, you know, the Aryan Jesus, white Jesus, blonde hair, blue eyes, he's glowing, he has a lamb around his shoulder. You seen that photo? You know what I'm talking about, the painting? Just imagine he just broke its leg. Changed, coiffed hair. But, and listen, that's interesting because God does allow pain in our lives. There's probably any number of you in this room that there's pain in your life. And you've been wandering around just, it's mercy to you that you feel pain. It's grace to you that God allows pain in your life, that you're drawn back into a connection with him. So he changes his audience. He's okay, that's for sheep. Then the next audience, second audience, it's really interesting that he picks this audience because you, again, you see the focus of Jesus in this. And he focuses on single ladies. All the single ladies. Put your hands up, up. Any single ladies in the room today? Single ladies, just put your hand up. Put your hands up, up, up. Uh-oh. Yeah, okay, yep. Few? Only a few. You're not sure what I'm going to do, so you're like, I'm not raising my hand. Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. I'm not going to do anything to you, I promise. So a few single ladies. So this is for you. He picks you out of the crowd. He goes, I got a story to tell you. And this is the story. Here's how it goes. There's a woman. She has 10 coins. She loses one of the coins. And it's like, oh no, one of the coins is missing. Calls all her friends together. They search the house. They scour through the house to find the one coin. And when they find the one coin, they all celebrate. Oh, I found my lost coin. This is great. And they celebrate. And then again, same little phrase, Jesus says, in the same way, I tell you, there's rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, again, context is important here. Here's what's going on. In the ancient world, in the time where Jesus was teaching, single women would have a necklace of 10 coins. And this necklace denoted that they were single, they were from a family of wealth, and it was a symbol that when you went out and about, that like, I'm available. You can have all this and the coins. And it was a way of looking right, you know, in case you saw Mr. Right. Right, single ladies, you know what I'm saying? Right? I mean, like you came to church today, like, this is a good place to look right. I mean, this is a good place. Where are you going to meet a guy? This is a good place to meet a guy, right? Amen? Everyone's like, no, this is getting uncomfortable. But it's just true. Like this is where, you know, so if you come to this place trying to look right, you know, you got your best stuff on. You got your hair right. You know, like, you want to look right. So imagine like this woman is like, I've lost a coin? I'm gonna go out with 9 coins? I'm not going out with 9 coins. What if I meet Mr. Right? And he's like, 1, 2, 3. That's interesting. She doesn't got her stuff together, right? Like I don't got time for that. So man, we got to get that coin. Friends all come together. We found it. Oh, whew, okay. Let's get our stuff on and go out and walk around town. Right? Like, that's what it is. There's an urgency to it. There's an intensity to it. We got to get this right. I mean, I don't know if when you read texts like this, how you read them or how they feel to you. It can feel strange to talk about people who are lost. It can be offensive, right? Like, oh, so you're found, so I'm lost. So you think you're better than me, right? Can you hear that? You ever heard people say that? Like, I'm from Colorado. I live in Denver, Colorado. We have 310 days of sun a year, full sun. So it's a lot. It's really similar to here. And I live in Denver, and about an hour and a half south is a city called Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs has like every Christian ministry known to man is in Colorado Springs. So Colorado Springs is Jerusalem, and we are Sodom and Gomorrah in Denver. But what's true, it's not far off, by the way, but in the Springs, if you're not a Christian and you're in the midst of all this Christian stuff, you're kind of really almost hostile because there's all these people of faith around you and you're not a person of faith. So there's kind of an aggressiveness, there's an intensity about it. And so one of the bumper stickers you see in Colorado Springs says, not all who wander are lost. and has all the religious symbols. You ever seen that bumper sticker? And it's pretty much a way of saying, oh, you think I'm lost? I'm not lost, I'm just wandering. Who do you think you are? It's like a way of pushing back. The other bumper sticker, if you just want to hear a funny one that you see all the time in Colorado Springs, is focus on your own damn family. Because there's a big ministry called Focus on the Family. Anyway, okay, so like, you know, people preach with bumper stickers. And it's pretty much a way of saying, how dare you? How dare you say I'm lost? And I understand that, honestly. I mean, you might be here and you're going, oh, so I'm the lost one. Well, listen to what Jesus is actually saying when he says something is lost. By saying something is lost, Jesus is saying it's valuable. It's valuable. Each of the stories, everything stops until it's found. It's value. Now, what would be a number of years ago, when I got engaged to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, Danielle, I gave her a ring, right? That's what you do. You give her a ring, engagement ring. And it literally cost all the money I had. I worked jobs, I waited tables, I saved money, and I bought this ring. And if I'm very honest, even looking back, it wasn't that nice of a ring, but it was the ring I could afford. It was all the money I had, and I gave her this ring. And about 2 weeks before our wedding, I'll never forget, I get a phone call, and she says, hey, Jay, I don't want you to be upset, which means you immediately get upset. But I lost the ring. I don't know where it is. And I was like, you know, it's fine. It's totally fine. Where are you right now? And she was at home. I said, I'm going to come over right now. We came over. I said, it's fine. Everything's fine. She's crying. I said, you know, where do you remember having it? And she's like, well, I think maybe I put it on the sink. I was washing my hand. Okay, you know, let's start there. Let's start with the sink. And, you know, so you go to the sink. You know, let's check the dressers. Let's check it. You know this feeling? And you're starting to search, and urgency's going up more and more and more and more, and it's getting more and more intense. Before you know it, we're taking apart the sink. You know, you're looking. And I'll never forget, on my hands and knees along the edge of the wall, feeling the carpet. Maybe it got jammed in there somehow. That's what Jesus is describing. Lostness is value. I mean, you lose all kinds of stuff you don't care about. You know, like when you graduate here, do you get a little diploma, like a certificate, right? You get that? Okay, yep. How many of you got one of those diplomas in your life? Most of you, right? Okay, a lot of you. How many of you know exactly where it is right now? Okay, you're weird. Those are the weird people. Just keep an eye on those people. Those are the people who are really organized. Those are weird people. The rest of us are like, I have no idea where that is. Who cares? It's not technically lost. You just don't care, right? Like, whatever. I don't know. It's a piece of paper. It's somewhere. Some of you are organized, and that's it's a disease. The rest of us are like, whatever. I don't know. It's somewhere. It's not technically lost. I just don't care. Jesus is saying, no. You are so valuable that everything stops until you're found. Listen to me. It's really important you hear me right now. There's maybe even just one of you in this room that's far from God. You know you're far from God. You may have wandered away. You may have never even thought about any of this, and you're here today and you have no idea why. I need you to hear me. It's really important you listen to me right now. The eyes of God are on you in a way that are not on the rest of us. God is looking at you intently with love. He's drawing you. Hear this. He's looking right past us, the rest of us in this room. He's drawing you. He's calling you home. He's pulling out all the stops to find you. Now, I realize as I say that, what that does is offend the rest of us. What do you mean? It's not about me? I don't know. The text says there's more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than 99 who don't need to. The scriptures are clear. The value is tilted towards the outsider, the one who is lost. And the last story demonstrates it very poignantly. It's commonly called the prodigal son. You ever heard of that? The prodigal son? It should be called the lost son. The prodigal really means extravagant or lavish, wasteful. It should, if it's going to be called anything, it should be called the prodigal father. But I think it's better called the lost son, but whatever. People call it the prodigal son because he is also wasteful in a different way. But the story goes like this, if you've never heard it. There's two sons with a father, older and a younger, of course. And the younger one decides, you know, I'm not sure I want to wait for you to die. Can I just have my inheritance now? And he gets enough courage to like say it to his dad. Hey, dad, I know you're going to die and one day I'll get some money. How about I just don't wait for you to die? And can I have it now? I've preached this story in different places in the Middle East. I've preached in Amman, Jordan. When I said that exact thing, just that, the room gasped. Because in the ancient world, or really even now, or in many parts of the world, the idea that the younger child would try to skip the older and honestly say, I want money before you die. I mean, it's effectively saying, I wish you were dead. I have two girls. And if either of my girls, let alone my younger, looked at me and said, you know, Dad, I wish you were dead, but you're not. Can I have my money now? I would probably say something like, you're going to wish you were dead soon. I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. You know, of all the things I would do, I'll tell you what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't give her the money. And here's what's crazy about this text. He gives him the money. He splits the money and he gives it to him. This demonstrates the generosity of God. God gives you your life. He gives you abundantly. And he says, you know what? I'm going to trust you with your life. I mean, have you ever thought about how crazy that is? He trusts you with your life when you are a dumb sheep. When you make decisions to just only benefit you. They're just for you. He says, it's okay. I'm going to give you the ability to do that. And of course, the story goes on, and it's not that surprising. This young son wanders away immediately, leaves home, takes the money and leaves. And the NIV renders it in a funny way. It says, and he squandered his wealth in wild living. I love that. Later in the text, we realize it involves at least gambling and prostitutes. But they say the in wild living. It's effectively, he lives out a hip-hop video for his life. I know you don't know what that means because you're Christians. But you could ask a friend at work, what is this thing called hip-hop? And what is a video of the hip-hop? But he loses it all. It's all gone. And something happens that he doesn't expect is it says that a famine came upon the land. And by the way, this is what happens to every prodigal son or daughter. They think they're in control. They're going to do what they want to do. They don't expect the famine. They don't expect something to go wrong. The famine comes as he's walked away from his father, and of course, symbolizing God. And a famine comes. Listen, everyone will hit a famine. You lose the job. Your health begins to fail. Your marriage falls apart. Your kids get into trouble. Something that is not in your control will hit you often. And again, it's a way to try to wake you up. To kind of put your life back in order, to find a life with God. Of course, it doesn't work if you know the story. It says, when the famine hits the land, he has no money. He goes and hires himself out as a pig farmer. He's feeding pigs. Good Jewish boys feeding pigs, taking care of pigs. That's terrible. And then one day, while he's taking care of the pigs, it says he starts staring at the pig food and is like, pig food. That looks good. And there's a turning in Luke 15. It's a little phrase, and I don't know if you underline your Bible. It's worth underlining. It says, and suddenly he came to his senses. What does it take for someone to come to their senses? Have you had moments where you come to your senses? You just wake up, like, what am I doing? I got to tell you, I've been a pastor now for decades. I have no idea what it takes for someone to come to their senses. Why is it the pig food? Why not the famine? Why not working with pigs? I have no idea. But it's something about the pig food. He's like, what am I doing? This is dumb. But all I want to say to you pastorally is, when you come to your senses, you better act. Because you'll fall right back asleep. When you come to your senses, you go, this doesn't make sense. What am I doing with my life? How am I still living in this addiction? What have I done? I mean, I lost my marriage, or I've blown up this friendship. What am I doing? When you come to your senses, you better act, or else you'll just fall right back asleep. And something about this moment wakes him up. And so he thinks to himself, my father has all this money and this estate. What if I just went back to him? Maybe I could just go home. But it occurs to him, I can't just go home. I've screwed everything up. I blew the inheritance. I've ruined my life. I've shamed our family name. I can't just go home. So he makes a plan. And he starts preparing a speech. Have you ever prepared a speech when you know you screwed something up? Anybody ever been in school? You got to make a speech for why your homework isn't done. Anybody done this? You know, you're like going to school and you're like, oh, you know, the dog. Oh, no, I did the dog last time. Okay, my mom, she fell down. I was like, oh, no, mom. And, you know, we had to go to the hospital. And I didn't get a chance to get to my math homework, you know. Or maybe that was a little too much. Mom, you know, mom. Oh, no, mom. Oh, no. You know, you practice. You get the intonation right. You get the phrasing. You got to get the story right. Anybody, you done that with school? Or anybody married? Right? Like, you know, you're driving, like, I can see the food getting cold on the table. Oh, traffic. I mean, have you seen the traffic? Right, you work it out. You get dramatic pauses. Okay. Well, he's prepared a speech. Now, we know he's prepared a speech because he's saying it to himself in the text. And here's the speech. It goes like this. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Just make me like one of your hired servants. That's the speech. And he's practicing. Father. I've sinned. I have sinned. And he's practicing. He's walking along. He's practicing. And as he's practicing, he's getting closer to home. He looks up. And who does he see? But he sees his father running. Now, it's impossible to describe how strange this would be. Patriarchs in the ancient world, they never ran. People came to see them. If they were going to go anywhere, they walked. And that means that he has probably long robes, and he's picked these robes up, and he's hiked them up, which is just undignified. And he's running. So he sees him running. He's like, I've never seen him run. This is unusual. Now he's 50 feet away. Boy, he's running really fast. 40 feet away, 30 feet away, 10 feet away. What would you be thinking is going to happen? You've screwed everything up. You've wasted all the money. You've blown your life up. You've dishonored your family. Now he's 5 feet away. Wouldn't you think that you should probably duck your head a little bit? I don't know if you knew this little trick if you're ever in a fight, like, you just put your head down, they punch you on the top of the head, it'll break their hand. So you just go like this, if you're ever gonna hit. Anyway, none of you will ever do that, you're good Christians. But you can imagine he ducks a little because he's waiting for a slap. How dare you? How dare you think you can come home? Look at what you've done. You've made a mess of everything. So he's waiting for. What happens? Father throws his arms around him and he starts to kiss him and hug him. And you would think in this moment, it would occur to him, oh, I'm safe. I'm home. Thank you.
Is that what happens?
No. He starts his stupid speech. Father. I mean, hugging him, kissing him. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. Here's the only thing we know is the speech that he practices a few verses earlier versus the speech he gives doesn't finish because the father interrupts him. He won't let him finish his stupid speech. He says, he calls the servants, quick, come, put a robe on my son, put sandals on his feet, put a ring on his finger. Kill the fattened calf and let us celebrate. For this son of mine who was dead is now alive. I think maybe right then he goes, oh, I'm safe. I'm home. See, listen. What God has for you is mercy and grace. I want you to imagine, this is hard to imagine, but imagine you're playing cards with God. Like some of your Baptists are like, not allowed to do that. But anyway, imagine you're playing cards with God. You ever play cards with somebody? You ever play cards with somebody who's bad at playing cards? And like their hand keeps dropping? So imagine you're playing cards with God. He's a bad card player. So he's like this. You're like, I can see your cards. Oh, I'm sorry, sorry. I can see your cards. You got, you know, playing a game. You know, if I can see your, okay. I'm so, so sorry. You keep playing, keep talking. I can see your cards again. This is getting awkward. Can you put your cards up? And God says, you know, I'll tell you what. How about we stop playing the game? Why don't I just show you what's in my hand? All that I have for you is grace. Every card, all I have is mercy. All I have is acceptance. All I have is love. My son, Jesus, he paid for everything. Just come home. Just come home. All I have is grace for you. Just come home. See, if you had to wonder, if I come to God honestly, if I really confess my sin, if I really talk about what's going on the inside, if I come home, if you had to wonder at all, whether you would get a slap or a hug, you would not come. And that's why he has paid for it all. That's why everything's been paid for. He is a God of love, and he accepts you right as you are. Come home. Yield to the mercy of God. Surrender. It doesn't matter where you've been. It doesn't matter what you've done. Yield. Come home. Home. And yet, that's not the end of the story. The story ends in a really strange way. It ends with the older brother walking up and hearing a party. He's been working in the field all day. And he goes, what is this party about? He calls a servant and goes, what's going on? He goes, you didn't hear? Your brother's home. He goes, my brother's home? Yeah, he's home. He's throwing a party for him. The older son goes, well, this is ridiculous. Goes back to work. And the father has to leave the party and come and get and talk to the older brother. He says, son, did you not hear? Your brother's home. He goes, yeah, I heard. I heard he's back. Whoa. Come and celebrate for this brother of yours. He's back. He's alive. What are you doing? It's time to celebrate. He says, oh, so I'm just supposed to celebrate. I've been here working the whole time. He takes your money. He takes our money. And he spends it on prostitutes and gambling. And he comes home. And you're like, oh, we're just going to all have a celebration. No. It's not fair. This isn't right. I'm not doing it. But son, well, you got to come in. Okay, so you're going to kill the fat calf? You haven't even given me a goat. I haven't gotten anything. You celebrate him. But son, your brother, he was dead, and now he's alive. Come in and celebrate. And the story ends.
cliffhanger. Will the brother come in or will he stand out? We don't know. Story ends. And remember, he's talking to the Pharisees, like, are you going to join or not? I understand it frustrates you that this other thing's happening, but will you join or not? And frankly, it's the same question that sits before us today. Will you join in the search party? Will you join the celebration? Will you be a part of what God is doing in the world? Because it's just not about you. But you get to be in a continual celebration on behalf of how God is rescuing and redeeming the world, if you will join, if you will get over yourself, if you will not make it about what you need and what you want and what you desire, you can be a part of what God is doing in the world. And listen, it doesn't matter if it's not your party, it's still a party. And you're invited if you will participate. But you have to choose to not just make it about you. Amen? Why don't we stand together?